It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists are working on ways to capture PFAS and destroy them, but it's not simple with these toxic human-made forever chemicals that are pervasive in our environment, especially in wells near chemical manufacturing plants and airports using firefighting foam. But a breakthrough now to this growing global health threat with research published last month in the journal Science. Join in on the work to eliminate PFAS chemicals, 800-642-1234. Dan Jones is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at Michigan State University, associate director of its Center for PFAS Research. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thank you for having me today.
Well, we've nicknamed them forever chemicals because they don't go away. They don't degrade. Does the science that's emerging mean that that label is no longer correct?
Well, I mean, when we say call them forever chemicals, it's really that there are very few natural processes, especially in the soil and water, whereby these compounds will break down into harmless materials. So there are many groups that are working on developing technologies to try to break them down, but there are a lot of challenges that all of them still face, because these are very stable chemicals. They're difficult to break down. But the paper that was published by the Northwestern group in Science recently showed that there was some novel chemistry that really hadn't been appreciated before that has potential to lead these kinds of developments further.
And you're examining methods of breaking down PFAS. And you say once PFAS are filtered out of water or another substance, that they must be destroyed. You can't store or bury them in a landfill. Why is that?
Well, in part because they don't break down, and they're somewhat mobile in the environment. So if we bury them in the landfill and then rainwater percolates through the landfill, eventually these chemicals migrate through the soil and end up in groundwater. And then from there, they move on to other bodies of water and into our food supply.
What happens if you incinerate PFAS?
Well, if you have a flame that's hot enough, you probably can break them down very efficiently, but there are relatively few incinerators that operate at such high temperatures that have been documented really to be effective in breaking down the wide range of different PFAS chemicals. So incineration is an option, but at least in the state of Michigan, I'm not aware of any incinerators that operate under the conditions that would pretty much guarantee that these chemicals would be broken down into harmless materials.
And that's the crux of it. If organic chemists can create these seemingly indestructible chemicals, these forever stable, as you say, then they shouldn't they also have the knowledge and ability to break them apart and destroy them, to undo their handiwork?
Well, we don't really require that of manufacturers and people who develop new chemicals, to insist that the chemicals don't have almost infinite lifetimes in the environment. That's not a requirement, especially for chemicals that are not viewed as being harmless when at the time of their development, or being harmful at the time of development. So we don't really, as a world, we don't really demand that that the materials that we develop are eventually going to break down through natural processes.
But you really have to pay attention, though, to what you're creating and its entire life cycle, especially as scientists try to develop ways to destroy PFAS.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The biggest, one of the biggest challenges with PFAS is that there are so many different chemicals. And a process may break down some of them, but not all of them. But we don't even have reference materials to work from for many of these chemicals. They're not, commercially available. Beyond that, the processes may end up creating more damaging compounds by breaking down PFAS. We might turn salts and sort of natural substances into to hazardous substances. So we have to do look at the bigger picture of how do we dispose of chemicals and how long do we want them to last. I mean, these products are really valuable from a consumer's point of view, but from an environmental point of view, everything should be designed so that it doesn't last forever.
We have Michigan State biochemist Dan Jones with us working on PFAS containment techniques, what the future holds for these so-called forever chemicals leaching into our environment. Join in on the challenges of destroying PFAS. What questions come up for you? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers have developed potentially promising methods to destroy a class of PFAS chemicals using lye, which is a common, inexpensive ingredient. So-called forever chemicals, they're widely used in products like firefighting foams, nonstick cookware, makeup, waterproof clothing, and they typically don't break down. So degrading one major type of PFAS in the lab could be a step forward. Join in on the science of tackling PFAS in the environment. Potential solutions, 800-642-1234. Michigan State biochemistry professor Dan Jones is associate director of the university's Center for PFAS Research and stays with us. Dan, your colleagues at Michigan State are working on a way to add materials to soil that would prevent plants from taking up PFAS. Now, when I think of PFAS, I often think of water contamination, not about the soil, not about, you know, the plants. Can you explain the issues there in the environment?
Well, I'll give an example of of some of the problem. Some the chemicals that end up in water sometimes end up being treated in wastewater treatment plants. And the PFAS chemicals are not degraded there. They end up in the biosolids, in this instance, the sludge. And in many cases, that sludge is then applied to farms as fertilizer. So the PFAS are moving from the water into the sludge and then into the farms, where in some cases they could be taken up by crops, they could be taken up by livestock, and they then have potential to enter the food supply. So because the chemicals don't break down naturally, and certainly they don't break down in wastewater treatment, we really just move them around from one place to the next in the absence of having a way to destroy them.
What ultimately would be the best way to either store them or make them so they wouldn't leach into other areas of the natural world, the environment?
Well, my colleague, Professor Hoi Lee, is working on soil amendments, things that you can add to the soil that that might bind up the PFAS or at least slow down their migration into the water, into groundwater, and into uptake into crops. And there are many different approaches that may work, but the long-term issue is probably we still need to find ways to break them down. And even more importantly, we need to find ways to eliminate those chemicals that are going to cause problems. So, I mean, there are replacement chemicals that probably could be suitable substitutes that are not going to last nearly as long as many of the PFAS chemicals do.
You mentioned this earlier, and let's dig in a bit deeper. Scientists at Northwestern, they released research last month showing that a class of PFAS can be broken down into mostly harmless components using sodium hydroxide, the lye that used to be commonly used in soap. What do you see in this research? What is new to you here?
Well, I think just the real novelty is that these chemical reactions work in the first place. But I don't think they've been widely appreciated that this could work. But to get them to work, they have to use a particular kind of solvent, which then, of course, to implement this, you'd need to remove that solvent from the drinking water. But the main The really important advance here is to show that the process works. And now there's a lot of work that needs to be done, probably to optimize this and to find ways to scale it up so that it can be useful on a large scale contamination site and not just in the laboratory.
Right, because as
That
a
that's generally true. That's just, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say this
That's generally
solvent,
true for yes, go ahead.
the solvent DMSO, I mean, how do you dispose of it? One scientist questioned the real world application of this breakthrough because you can't put DMSO down the drain.
Well, I mean, DMSO is largely a harmless chemical. It's I mean, not entirely true for just about anything, but DMSO, you would eventually, if you're using it to and mixing it in with water, you wouldn't want to remove it from the water. And that, of course, takes energy. It has some costs associated with it. So there's a lot of engineering in this and really almost all of the technologies to try to make them useful on a large scale. I mean, many work beautifully at the small scale in the laboratory, but to get them to work with, you know, millions of gallons of water or many acres of contaminated soil is another story altogether.
Or 12,000 types of PFAS, I would imagine. I mean, how can a method developed in a lab, using lye and DMSO be applied to other types of classes of PFAS and be scaled up enormously?
Well, I think that the important thing is that they've discovered that this kind of chemistry can happen. Now, how to make it happen and make it practical is another, that's really an engineering problem more than anything else. But there's a lot of additional basic science research that will need to be done to find the right conditions. I mean, DMSO is, it was proposed in part because it's mostly harmless and it's relatively inexpensive as a solvent.
If you're
But
just
it still would need to be removed from the water supply.
joining us, we're talking about the challenges of destroying PFAS with Dan Jones. He is the Associate Director for Michigan State University's Center for PFAS Research. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jane is with us from Suamico. Jane, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I'd really like to hear him comment on what I've been hearing, that there is a large group of these kind of chemicals, like 5,000 different variations, and that the legislature and the Natural Resources Board don't want to call them, they don't want to call individual ones out because there are so many of them.
So the quantity Jane brings up, what roadblocks do you see there, Dan, especially as states try to regulate PFAS?
This is one of the big challenges that I think we particularly face in with PFAS, is that there are so many different chemicals, and we know very little about which ones are the most harmful and those that are not. There are two that the EPA has designated to be considered as hazardous chemicals, and that will enable certain kinds of regulations. But that ignores, I mean, one estimate I saw recently was that there are maybe 12,000 different PFAS chemicals, and that number is, excuse me, and that number is growing all of the time. So, how we regulate them and how we assess what the health effects are of being exposed to mixtures are two big areas of research, and those are things, some things that my colleagues around the world are really working on.
What are the issues and obstacles around the cost of cleanup efforts? You looked at a project near a former military base in Sacramento that has cost over $3 million to date, and that's just to prevent PFAS from going into the drinking water of one single community. Why are cleanup efforts so costly?
Well, the scale is really the issue. The unit that we described in our piece in the conversation on in the Sacramento area is next to a defunct Air Force base, and it's processing, you know, thousands of gallons of a minute of water. But the size of the activated carbon filters and the pumps and the equipment that's needed is really substantial. And you're right that this only addresses a very localized area. We don't really have a complete understanding across the U.S. just where the big the hot spots of contamination are. So the big part that has to precede all of this is to identify where is the problem the worst and to try to intervene where the where most human health and most wildlife health is likely to be affected.
Dan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Kate. Hope that we raise some awareness in the public that that these are issues that are going to be with us for a while.
Indeed. Dan Jones, professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at Michigan State, associate director of its Center for PFAS Research. We have a link to the research article in the journal Science at WPR.org/mornings. Up ahead, we delve into the pros and cons behind baby bonds with a UCLA professor who studies these trust funds that mature in adulthood. Could they address the wealth gap in America? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update and a story from Wisconsin Life. They're next on the Ideas Network.